Accession number 29529, Mr. Tom Austin, Panel 6. Now, what was the this evasive action? Was this a corkscrew?
Corkscrew, yeah, a corkscrew.
Now, what was it? How were you trained?
Well, you started by doing it, pulling up sharply to the starboard, shall we say, and then you would come down. It was almost a figure of eight in the air.
And what was it like to do that? Was it, I mean, you know...
Well, it gave you confidence that you could manoeuvre the aeroplane if it was in a difficult position and recover. That's one main thing. Of course, we did it further.
Throw you about, you know.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, you had to be strapped in, obviously. Because the time of year we won OTU wasn't the best time of the year. I mean, we going into the winter months.
You seem to have got there late September and were there
in right.
November.
That's right. And so we experienced... adverse weather, you might say, quite often.
Then you got the Wellington Mark 3s,
which was a very good aeroplane. The engines, of course, were Hercules engines, which are... the one thing about the Wellington, of course, was the fact that radial engines could take much more punishment than an inline engine. An inline engine, for instance, if the coolant was hit... your engine was absolutely US. But it was known fact that on the radial engine, you could even have a couple of pots knocked clean out and the aircraft or the engine would still operate, which was a big saving in lots of cases.
So that was the difference between
the in nine, yeah.
The three?
Yeah.
Any other differences?
Well, no, the ones, it was not, it was a Pegasus engine, the one. Wasn't such a powerful engine. Then we went to threes, Hercules. And then, of course, further we had the 10s, which were...
Any other differences with the 3, then? Or was it just
you could get higher for a start.
So it was just the engine?
Just the engine, basically. The actual aircraft itself wasn't any different.
So you got them in November. Any other aspects of the training as a crew?
No. Obviously, all our time together, we used to, leisure time, we would go out together.
We socialised together,
yes. I mean, as a matter of fact, I mean, I didn't drink then, but I would go in a pub, obviously, and have a non-alcohol drink. But,
did you get close to them? Because they were quiet lads, you said, most of them.
Oh, yes, yeah. As I say, the one... problem I had was with Huey, the rear gunner, who liked to sit up half a night gambling. Excuse me. Well, we all got on very well. I did have a slight doubt about Bill Bartlett. His navigation was acceptable, but it wasn't brilliant. I mean, and... of course, it came to a head when we were actually finishing. When we got to the end of our instruction there on OTU, the other members of the crew...
Now, that's before you go to the conversion unit.
That's right, yeah.
Halifax,
yeah.
So what happened?
Well, what happened was that the other members of the crew said to me, what did I think of Bill Bartlett? And... I said, well, I know what you mean. Whether do you think he would, his nerve would stand when we got on operations? This was the impression we got. And I said, well, although we've been told by the instructors what to expect in the way of anti-aircraft fire, etc., individually, we don't honestly know how we're going to react ourselves until we get there. So would you agree that we wait until we get on a squadron and start operating before we make any decision about this? And they eventually agreed with me. But unfortunately, of course, it turned out later that they were right. We got sent to the conversion unit on the Halifaxes. That was at Lindholm.
What was your first? What was that? That's where you're getting used to.
The
four engine or
four engine, then.
And that's number 1656.
That's right. Yeah. Now, you've got to bear in mind that all these training units, like OTU and the conversion units, they were old aircraft. In other words, they'd served their purpose on squadrons, etc., and they weren't in the best condition as far as engines were concerned, etc. Well, we started flying there.
That's the Halifax 2, Mark 2.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, we picked up an engineer then. And
tell us about him first. Who was it?
The engineer was what I would always say a self-made man. He was much older than we were. Nobby Clark. Very, very keen. But we found out afterwards that he was convinced that if anything went wrong with the aircraft with four engines stopping, he could fix it, you know, which was a good thing. After all, he was confident about this. And then, of course, we had an extra mid-upper gunner.
And who was that?
And now, to be honest with you, I can't remember his name. It's one of the names that is just gone. He was quite a young lad and very pleasant chap. So we then, a crew of seven.
Now, what about the Halifax? What did you think of the Halifax?
Well, the ones we were flying were what we term clapped out, you know. But obviously, when you took an aircraft up, you had to do necessary checks on the aircraft engines, etc. And I can distinctly remember one particular instance in this when we were flying. And it was on a Sunday morning, and we were briefed to go up with the instructor, a warrant officer, and to practice three engine flying. In other words, to prove to ourselves that you could fly on three engines and possibly fly on two. We got into the aircraft and started it up. And there was a limit to what you could allow for the mag drop on each engine. And on all four engines, there was a considerable mag drop, definitely, which if I was in charge of the airplane, I would not have accepted it. But the instructor said, oh, it is clear in the air, famous last words as far as we were concerned. And so we took it up. And I was told to fly to go to 3,000 feet. And he would instruct me then to feather a particular engine, feather the prop, and start flying on three engines. Well, we didn't get to 3,000 feet. We were at about 2,500 when the port outer stopped. Excuse me. And he said, right, feather the prop and trim the aircraft so that you're flying on three engines, straight and level, etc., which we did. And he said, also, call up the airfield. And looking back again in hindsight, it was rather peculiar because he said, call them up and tell them that we're coming in for an emergency landing. Well, as I say, from hindsight, we were up to prove we could fly on three engines. So I didn't really see, looking back now, where the emergency arose. Anyway, I was instructed to fly to the air, get permission to land. Well, we put the wheels down, the flaps down, and it was trimmed very nicely coming in on three engines until we got to about 400 feet. And at 400 feet, the port inner stopped, which put us in rather a predicament because we had two engines on the starboard side operating, nothing on the port. And so we were just couldn't keep straight at any rate. We managed to get the undercarriage up and got some of the flap off as well. And it was obvious, though, I think we got back up to about 500 or 600 feet. But it was obvious we weren't going to hold the aircraft on those conditions. And, of course, we're turning away from the airfield. After all, we were actually on the actual approach when this happened. and it was obvious we were going to crash. We hit the trees. There was a area of land there, which I, to this day, I'm not quite sure, although I did see it only a couple of years back. I got a feeling that they may have been taking peat out of the ground. There were these long trenches, and on the top, they had these little tipper trucks, which whatever was coming out the ground was being put in. And anyway, we hit the trees and crashed on the this area. And fortunately, we all got out okay. We could have gone out, I mean, some of them could have gone out the wrong side and dropped down about 10 feet down a hole, but we got out okay, and the aircraft started to burn. Well, having got ourselves out, we saw in the distance a farm. It'd be about a mile away, and we started to walk towards this. The rear gunner, incidentally, said that he'd be concussed. We'd hardly got away from the airplane when we saw a gentleman taking his Sunday morning stroll. He'd obviously seen the aircraft crash, and he was walking around the lanes there, and he was walking towards the aircraft. Well, at any rate, we managed to go back and get him out of the way. When we got towards this farm, we were within about 20 to 30 yards, where they'd sawn some trees down, and there were these big tree trunks on the ground. So nobody incidentally came out from the farm, so whether there was anybody in residence there, I wouldn't know. We sat down on these tree trunks and waited developments. As I say, we were all able to walk. And first of all, we heard the fire engine coming out. Now, in those days, of course, even the service fire engines, they had a bell on it. No sirens. And we saw the fire engine come out and went on a little bridge across one of these dikes. And the bridge gave way and the fire engine went straight down into the dike. So it never did reach the aircraft. So it's by this time was burning quite merrily. And we sat and waited. And then about half an hour later, we saw a little waft coming towards us. Oh, turned out to be, she said, I'm the ambulance driver, but unfortunately I can't get the ambulance because of the state of the ground in nearer than about a quarter of a mile. Can you all walk? So we said yes. Well, we walked with her to the ambulance, which was a soft top. It was a small standard van converted into an ambulance. And we all got in. And she was in such a confused and highly strung state. It was probably her first crash she'd ever attended. And we no sooner got in than suddenly we get a lurch and she's taken us off the road straight into a ditch. So we all get out and we actually had to get the ambulance out of the ditch. That was, we had to go out of a medical examination when we got back. The following few days later...
Now, that just from your logbook, just so that people gives people an idea when that was on the 13th of December.
Yeah, the 13th of December, yeah. And as I say, although it was wartime, there didn't appear to be any work going on in this site where we crashed, apparently. I think it was a reaction to the fact that we had crashed, that when I went back flying and landed in the aircraft, I found I was landing high. In other words, once the ground got very near, I was levelling out, which was obviously, as I say, I think a reaction to the fact that we'd crashed only a couple of days previously. At that time,
how did the rest of the crew react?
Well, they were okay. I mean, there was no problem with them at all. But a signal came through. They wanted an urgent replacement crew for Wellingtons on 199 Squadron at Blighton. And as I was having this difficulty getting back flying on the Halifax landing, we were posted to 199 Squadron as a Wellington crew, just five of us.
You lost the two at the end.
Yeah.
And this was a Wellington Mark III with 9.9 squadron.
Yeah. And
how did you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I was perfectly happy about flying a Wellington. This was Christmas Eve, I think, 1942. I think it was actually snowing at the time, if I remember rightly. Anyway, we had to report to Blighton in Lincolnshire.
And what sort of reception did you get, you know, when you joined? Because it's your first real squadron.
Yeah. Well, strange you should say that, because we arrived late in the afternoon, not knowing anybody, and being Christmas Eve, the sergeants in the mess made us very welcome, as a matter of fact. Said, well, we're all going down to the local pub this evening, join us. And that's how we got introduced to a lot of members of the squadron. The sort of thing then was that if you went in the pub, you had a big metal jug full of beer and you poured it out. And as I say, I didn't drink much anyway, so, well, I didn't drink any alcohol at that time.
And what about reception from your officers, you know?
They were very good. We had no difficulty, and of course we experienced then our first Christmas dinner with where the officers serve the airmen, and the sergeants go to the airmen's mess as well to serve their Christmas dinner. It's strange, in the morning there's a football match, if you could call it a football match. The whole of the station get out on the playing fields, you kick a ball around, and it's a wonder you don't injure yourself. But it's a tradition sort of thing that this happens on a Christmas morning before you have Christmas lunch, etc. So that was the Christmas. And we hadn't been at Blighton long before the squadron was transferred to Ingham.
Is that also in Lincolnshire?
Also in Lincolnshire.
And it's spelled I-N-G-H-A-M?
I-N-G-H-A-M. Now, Ingham was next door to Scampton, but it was a grass airfield. Blighton, incidentally, wasn't. I had runways there. But Ingham was a grass field. And then we were a satellite airfield for the, let me see, if you could turn it at the moment, I'll give you the name. Ingham was a satellite airfield to Hemswell, H-E-M-S-W-E-L-L, which was full runways there. But it was actually occupied at that time by two Polish squadrons.
And that was in February, you seem to have
gone. Yes, round about.
Now, let's cut back from that, because that's a sort of month or so in advance. Now, you did your first few flights Blighton.
Well, yes, Blighton. I flew, but it was practice flying. We didn't actually do an operation from Blighton.
Now, anything you were learning there in these practice flights?
One of the things...
There's a sea search.
Sea search, yes. Well, we were called out to do sea searches. If it had been a raid the night before, we weren't on it, and there were known aircraft down, we were asked to, or ordered to go out and make a search for these people. Mm-hmm. Who'd possibly been a dinghy. There was another thing that used to happen. Once we got to Ingham, there was always a crew who was made to put on standby.
Now, hang on. You seem to have done two operations from... What would happen on one of these sea searches, then? I mean,
well, the sea search, you did an organised navigational search, decreasing the area, etc. But, unfortunately, we never did find anybody. It's a very difficult thing, you see, because you've got to fly at a medium height to see anything. Well, to make any use, you'd have to be above 2,000 or 3,000 feet. It's no good going right down on the sea. Otherwise, you just wouldn't pick anybody up, at any rate.
Now, what about the... you seem to have flown an operation on Lorient.
Yeah, Lorient. From, well, Lorient from, was... From, yeah.
From the first one, Blighton.
Yeah. Well, Lorient is the submarine port on the west coast of France.
That was the first operation.
That was the first... The first... I got sent as a supernumerary with an experienced crew. You went with them. It wasn't to assess you, it was to give you an idea of what an operation was like. The rest of the crew didn't go, I just went as another pilot. And it was a bombing raid on Lorient, the port. And as a matter of fact, we actually, when we got there, we did the run-in. We had quite a lot of anti-aircraft fire, etc. And I was amazed to find, as I was standing in, looking out the dome at the back, and the pilot called out, "Dummy, run." So we went round again. And to be honest with you, I... considered then, well, that is one thing I should never do on my own. I make a run in and I continue to run. I don't come round looking for medals. Well, that's the impression you got. He was actually an ex-army chap. He was a cavalry
officer, Powell.
Yeah, he was a ex-army cavalry unit he was in, apparently, and he transferred to the Air Force and got his pilot's wings. Very keen chap. The operation, I mean, I saw for the first time what anti-aircraft fire was like, etc. But the other thing I was going to say was the fact that every day one crew was put on standby for what we used to call...
Hang on, because you're jumping ahead. So that's when you move to...
Ingham. Yeah.
And that happens in February.
February, yeah.
Because... they seem to have more operations before the move. That's not how you... No, yes, there's one more sea search, right. So they go to England round about February the 3rd.
That's right, yeah.
From the looks of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Now, and then you seem to start operations straight away.
That's
now,
right.
Tell me about this spare crew.
Spare crew. Well, you were put on standby for what we used to call a Mona trip. The idea being that if the weather was bad, and after all we're still in the winter months there, the idea was to fly across to the continent and penetrate as far as you could whilst the weather conditions were clamped with a lot of cloud, etc. And the idea being to keep their heads down, in other words, for them to pack up work and get down in the shelters. Usually you went in into the Dutch coast, you see. That was the impression. It was rather a thing that people didn't like because you could, I mean, there was an experience, for instance, where a chap would go in all this claggy weather, and then suddenly the weather changed or the front had gone through, etc., and it was absolute sunshine, and he's sitting out there, you know, ready to be shot down if necessary, but... Anyway, and obviously then you did an immediate about turn and scamper for home as fast as you could. I never did. Very few people had to go on it, but you did have a standby for this particular duty if it
needed. So you never did that?
Never did it, no. We had sea searches, obviously. Then the operation started, and I think for the first three operations... we hit the targets all right, but on the way back...
Can we have a look at a typical raid?
Yeah.
Do you remember these first raids? They're all first four raids are on Lorient.
Yeah, yeah.
And then one on Wilhelm.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember, if we take you through a typical raid, that would be quite handy for us, just everything. Now, how would you... So if we take it from February, a raid on Lorient, how would you first know you were going up?
First know? Well, the signal would come through in the morning... from headquarters and asked for so many aircraft from that squadron. you had to, the squadron had to put up a list of aircraft that were available. And,
how would the squadron tell you?
Well, you reported to your flights down in the rooms where you sat around while you waited to go flying and et cetera, you see.
So what were the flying rooms like?
Well, in this case, in Ingham, they were brick-built buildings, but well, a few armchairs and that in it, et cetera, where you could relax and you would possibly study aircraft recognition and things like that.
And did they have anything like coffee or tea?
Oh, yes, you had a place where you could make a cup of tea, you know. So.
But darts or anything?
No, we didn't have that. The room was quite small. We all sat round there. There were two flights, if I remember rightly. And then the signal would come through, or at least the phone would be rung from the CO to say that operations were on that night. And so according to the time of year, it depended when we were going to go, obviously. Obviously, in the winter months, you went a lot earlier than you would in the summer months. You were told the time of briefing. And when you went down
so
to
briefing... what were you doing between the time of being told and briefing?
Well, in the time of that, you went and took the aircraft up to give it a flight test.
Now, tell me what a flight test is.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Well, to get the aircraft up and see if all the facilities were working.
Take the crew up or just
yourself? Oh, yes, you usually took the crew up. Because, after all, you'd certainly want the wireless operator and the navigator and the bomb aimer, so...
And how long would a flight test last for? It seems to be about 45 minutes.
That's about it.
So just to make sure things were going?
Just, exactly.
And they'd be all checking their bits?
They'd be checking their bits.
So after the flight test, getting near the briefing now?
Well, getting near the briefing, it'd probably be... early afternoon, you went to briefing.
Now, what exactly? Where would the briefing be?
The briefing would be in the briefing room, particularly. And the individuals, like the navigators, had separate briefings for their requirement. The wireless operators went to their section for their instruction, and the gunners went to their section. Then you came to a main briefing after that.
Now, what would happen in each of these separate briefings?
Well, in each of these separate briefings, they were briefed on their various aspects of their job. The navigators were told... Yeah. That, you see, at this time, you didn't know where you were going. You actually just reported to your sections. Then when the main briefing came up, everybody was assembled, and the when the CO came in with the various leaders of the various sections, there would be the navigation leader, the radio wireless section leader, the bombing leader, and also, of course, the most important, one of the most important men at that time, was a civilian, if I remember rightly, were the Met Office. Then, as they came in, the briefing started, and it wasn't until the curtain was drawn back on the map to show you where you were going to go, and then it was said, "Tonight, the briefing could be Lorient."